Now we continue Adam Zamoyski's biography of the brief but eventful life of the great romantic composer Frédéric Chopin, from Polish child prodigy to Paris dandy, his turbulent relationship with George Sand, and his early death penniless in Paris. Today, as Paris is shaken by revolution, Chopin seeks refuge in Scotland. The reader is Stephen Campbell Moore.
Chopin and George Sand arrived at her country house at Nohant in June. "We arrived safely," Chopin wrote to Gajimala. "Lovely countryside, nightingales, larks." Nohant was a comfortable 18th century manor house with its own park. Not far away, the River Indre flowed lazily through the flat landscape. Chopin was given a sunny room on the first floor with windows onto the garden. On one side, a door led to a small book-lined study, beyond which was George Sand's bedroom. Life at Nohant was informal. George Sand would spend the night writing. She went to bed at 5 or 6 in the morning and never got up before noon. Chopin, on the other hand, was always up in the early morning in order to work, and went to bed early. "We dine out in the open," wrote George Sand. "Friends come over, first one, then another. We smoke and talk, and in the evening, when they have gone, Chopin plays to me in the dusk, after which she falls asleep like a child." In August, Chopin wrote to Fontana that he would not be returning to Paris until the weather had changed, as the country air was doing him good. But the moment he felt better, he began to be bored. As George Sand put it, "Paris is good for his morale, and natures like his need to be surrounded by the refinements of civilization." In September, she moved into 2 small pavilions just off the Rue Pigalle. Chopin took an apartment at No. 5, Rue Tronchet. News of Chopin's arrival had spread, and within a couple of days he was besieged by would-be pupils. He gave up to 8 lessons a day, which sometimes exhausted him. Feeble, pale, coughing much, he often took opium drops with sugar or drank gum water, rubbed his forehead with eau de cologne, and nevertheless taught with a patience, perseverance and zeal which were admirable, as one pupil related. Chopin did not take part in any concerts that season. More often than not, he would drive round to the Rue Pigalle when his lessons were over and while away the evening with George Sand. Her lodgings there are described by Balzac in a letter to his Polish mistress. "She lives on Rue Pigalle, at the end of a garden over the stables of a house. There are paintings by Delacroix. The piano is magnificent, upright, of rosewood. Her bedroom is brown. Her bed consists of 2 mattresses on the floor, Turkish style. Chopin is always there. She only gets up at 4 o'clock, and at 4 o'clock Chopin has finished giving his lessons." Chopin's friend Gajimala was one of the habitués of the Rue Pigalle, along with Delacroix and Pauline Garcia Viardot, the renowned singer. The informal way of life there was congenial to Chopin, and he soon moved in himself. This had obvious advantages, and when he fell ill again in April, George Sand was able to help. But the living arrangement suited George Sand as well. Chopin provided both the excuse and the means for her to grow out of the affectation and licentiousness which had characterized her life during the 1830s. When they came together, she was still, with her philandering and her fantastic clothes, an object of scandal in many quarters. After a year or so with Chopin, she was rarely to be seen in anything but the simplest grey or black dresses, and her behaviour had grown more dignified. "A great, great piece of news is that little ship is going to give a great concert," George Sand wrote to Pauline Viardot in April 1841. The idea had come from a group of friends, and Chopin had only fallen in with it because he was certain that the various difficulties of arranging the event would induce them to drop the plan. But in a couple of days, most of the tickets had been sold. He then awoke as from a dream, writes Georges Sand, and there can be no funnier spectacle than the meticulous and irresolute Ship-Ship obliged not to change his mind any more. This Chopinesque nightmare will take place in Pleyel's salons on the 26th. He doesn't want any posters. He doesn't want any programmes. He doesn't want anyone to talk about it. He is afraid of so many things that I have suggested he play without an audience on a mute piano. It was only by retiring to his room and playing Bach fugues that he was able to calm his nerves. On the 26th of April, Delacroix came to collect Georges Sand and drove with her to the Salle Pleyel, where they found an audience of some 300 people filling the hall. Chopin played a selection of mazurkas and preludes, after which Madame Cinti d'Amoreau sang a couple of pieces. The reviews were unanimous in their praise. La France Musicale acclaimed Chopin as the creator of a school of piano playing and of composition, and added that he should not and cannot be compared to anyone. The craftsmanship of Chopin, which had been outshone in the Paris of the 1830s by Rossini, Liszt, and Berlioz, now appeared to many as the ultimate in artistry, and seemed to embody something more essential than the bombast of the previous decade. The result was that, as Liszt explained, it was not so much the school of Chopin as the church of Chopin. Delacroix called his music nourishment for the soul, and the German romantic poet Heinrich Heine discovered in Chopin a purer, therefore more universal artist than any other. Yes, one must admit that Chopin has genius in the fullest sense of the word, he mused. He is not only a virtuoso, he's also a poet. He can embody the poetry which lives within his soul. He is then neither a Pole, nor a Frenchman, nor a German. He reveals then a higher origin, that he comes from the land of Mozart, Raphael, and Goethe. His true fatherland is the dream world of poetry. That summer, Chopin accompanied Georges Sand to Nohant, where he hoped to be able to get down to his much-neglected compositions. And only 10 days after his arrival at Nohant in June, Chopin was able to send Fontana the first completed work, the Tarantella, Opus 43. This was followed over the next 2 months by a prelude, two nocturnes, and most important, the A-flat ballade, Opus 47, and the Fantaisie in F minor, Opus 49. These cobwebs and manuscriptical flies, as he called his manuscripts, were dispatched to Fontana for copying with the apology that the weather is beautiful and my music horrible. The weather was indeed fine that summer, and Chopin's health was good as a result. But as he is still at least 10 years too young to be a really good boy, wrote Georges Sand, he often gets bored in this happy state, and he thinks he's being idle since he's not crushed by work. From now on, her feelings towards him altered perceptibly. She began to humour him like a child rather than to challenge him like a lover. In September 1842, Chopin and Georges Sand moved to a new home in Paris. This was situated in the Square d'Orléans, a large private courtyard off the street. Georges Sand had taken an apartment on the first floor of number 9 for herself and her son Maurice. Across the gravel courtyard, Chopin had taken 2 rooms on the ground floor. The square was nicknamed La Petite Athènes, as it was favoured by artists and writers, and for Chopin it was an ideal arrangement. He was as independent of Georges Sand and her family as he could wish, while at the same time being close to her and other friends, whom he could call on whenever the need arose. Summers were spent at Nohant, but as soon as the guests had left, Chopin began to find the atmosphere stifling, and to long for Paris and the comfort of his friends. When he realised in 1843 that Georges Sand was planning to stay until the winter, he returned to Paris on his own. Georges Sand wrote, urging various friends to look after him. I know very well that he suffers without me, she wrote to Gajimala, but I also know that he would be saddened and almost humiliated if he saw me abandon my work in favour of being his sick nurse, as he puts it, poor child. Although I am his sick nurse so willingly, I miss him as much as he misses me. I miss his face, his voice, his piano, his slight sadness. I even miss the heart-rending sound of his cough. Poor angel. She had pampered Chopin from the start. She had often referred to him as her little one, but it was only now that she began to call him her son. And by the following year, she tried to laugh off his continuing love for her and branded it as sickly. She was beginning to face with trepidation the prospect of being lumbered for the rest of her days with somebody who was turning into a physical and, in her view, emotional invalid. She consoled herself as best she could by having a short affair with the young revolutionary Louis Blanc, and at the same time heaped more devotion on Chopin, who for his part sought consolation in music and in his friends. His health was quite good, but he was, according to George Sand, worrying like all sickly people and burying himself in advance all the time with a certain relish. Chopin's condition was aggravated by anxiety, particularly on account of his work. In 1845, he wrote 3 mazurkas and started on the Barcarolle, which some consider to be his greatest achievement. He was putting more and more thought into these later works, and their composition represented weeks of agonized reworking and frustration. His powers of concentration were failing, and his inspiration was beset by anguish, both emotional and intellectual. Meanwhile, George Sand had been working on a new novel, Lucrezia Floriani. It tells the story of a famous actress who, disillusioned with love and fame, retires to the seclusion of a remote lakeside villa and devotes herself to the upbringing of her illegitimate children. Chance brings 2 travellers into her wilderness, one a friend and admirer, the other a delicate, virginal, and melancholy prince. The prince falls ill, and by the time Lucrezia has nursed him back to life, they are in love. There follows a period of bliss, but gradually the prince's restless mind, his jealousy, and his malady begin to drive her mad. One day she simply dies of sorrow and exasperation. The book is unmistakably about Georges Sand and Chopin. This was clear to most readers in Paris as soon as the first installments began to appear in the press, and even as far away as St. Petersburg, the novelist Ivan Turgenev was in no doubt as to whom it referred. The book was a public humiliation of Chopin. As was her wont with new works, Georges Sand read out installments before Chopin and her house guests at Noant that summer. And while the others listened in horror, Chopin failed to spot the obvious. "I was in agony during the reading," recalled Delacroix. "The victim and the executioner amazed me equally. Madame Sand seemed to be completely at ease, and Chopin did not stop making admiring comments about the story."
Part 4 of Chopin, Prince of Romantics by Adam Zamoyski was read by Stephen Campbell Moore, abridged by Dory Nestel, and produced by Justine Willett.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, I'm Jim Lee. It's 3 o'clock and time for the stunning climax to our dramatisation of one of the great Russian novels. Then at 4, join Mel Gedroych as she celebrates the first ever Harry Potter night, uncovers the secrets of Sherlock Holmes, and hears from a girl who's determined to be one of the first humans on Mars. And a great lineup in the Comedy Club with John Holmes later this evening, including Down the Line at 10:30 and Cabin Pressure at 11:30. So now, it's Dostoevsky's tale of a good man in a morally corrupt and unfeeling world. In this concluding episode, Nastasya and Aglaya meet to talk over their feelings for Prince Myshkin as he begins to fear for his life.
The Idiot by Dostoevsky. Dramatised for radio in 4 episodes by Melissa Murray. With Paul Rees as Prince Myshkin, Alex Jennings as Ganya, Roger Allam as Rogozhin, Leah Williams as Nastasya, David Swift as General Yapanchin, and Paula Jacobs as Mrs. Yapanchin. Episode 4.
No. Put them over there. And then please move that lamp over there. Yes? Oh, that's better.
There's a gentleman here who wants to see you, Miss Aglaya.
A gentleman?
Well, Mr. Ganya Ivolgin, to be precise.
Oh.
Would I show him in, or will I show him the door, miss?
Oh, I'm very busy. I've 1,001 things to do before the party tonight.
He tried giving me 5 roubles and he's wearing cologne. I wouldn't buy.